Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that remembers all too well the time before films ever streamed on the internet, when we either saw them in theaters, chanced to see them at a film festival, waited months for them to come out on videotape, or never saw them at all. The three of us were reminded of those experiences this year when two of the most critically acclaimed movies of 2020, Chloe Zhao's Nomadland and Lee Isaac Chung's Minari, proved difficult to see until just this past week, when both became far more available to stream online. Let's begin this week's show by discussing a film that just might win Frances McDormand her sixth Oscar acting nomination. McDormand plays Fern, a woman whose life from the outside seems to be in limbo. Her husband has passed away. The town she lived in for decades, Empire, Nevada, has disappeared as well. Or at least its zip code has, leaving Fern with only her well-worn van, her memories, and the temporary job she pursues one after the next. In her travels, Fern meets and ends up embracing a community of fellow nomads, many of whom gather annually outside Quartzsite, Arizona, for a kind of therapeutic adult-style Burning Man gathering. Chloe Zhao's film, which she adapted from Jessica Butler's nonfiction book, is a perfect anti-Hollywood project, one that she fills with loving glimpses of the American West, especially the often snow-covered mountains, always majestic. And while Nomadland threatens at various points to go in a familiar direction, it never does. Instead, Zhao is content to simply explore facets of an American subculture, one that exists in some cases by necessity, but other cases by choice, on the edge of mainstream society, and McDormand proves perfect as the tough but ever-searching Fern acting as our guide.
Yeah, watching this movie and Chloe Zhao's last film, which was called The Rider, which is excellent, and I think people should seek it out if they didn't see it, I was kind of reminded how conditioned we become to narrative contrivance. Because all through this movie, I mean, it's like you said, Dan, you keep waiting for the manufactured conflict to come in. You keep waiting for her to be in some kind of danger. You keep waiting for the love interest. You keep waiting for a tortured explanation for why Fern has sort of left everything behind. And I mean, you get glimpses of all of those things. Like, you, as you said, you understand why she has kind of embraced itinerancy. I mean, she's kind of forced to embrace it, really, because like you said, her husband dies, the town's plant closes down, and that means everybody loses their job. The financial crisis kind of comes and robs everyone of everything. But I was just thinking about how another movie would have handled all of these, these things. And sometimes a great movie is great because of what it doesn't do. And Nomadland doesn't do a lot of things that you would expect. Because I think a lesser movie would have treated Fern and her itinerancy as like a pathology or maybe some kind of disorder. And I can just picture an ending where, you know, she falls in love. And there is, a, you know, there's sort of a flirtatious thing going on with a character played by David Strathairn in this film, in Nomadland, who's the only other recognizable actor in this. And I can imagine, you know, another narrative where they would have ended up together, where they would have, you know, found a home together, where she would have really come into herself because she finally had a place to settle down. And that's not what this movie is about, because that's not what real life is about. And I like the fine line that this movie walks, because it's showing how a lot of these people are out on the road or homeless because they don't have any other options. But it also shows how that doesn't mean they're totally hopeless, because they do have this community amongst themselves. They do find friendship and compassion with strangers. And I also love the way that characters in Fern's life will disappear and then kind of come back again. It's sort of this, like, this circle of life that's happening. So I think you could have gone multiple ways with this material and it could have fallen completely flat. They could have made it into some kind of melodrama. They could have made it into, you know, sort of a sad sack film about all of these depressing characters. And it's neither of those things. It's kind of its own thing. And I've seen it twice, and I was struck both times by just how well Chloe Zhao pulls this off, kind of a seemingly impossible task, and makes it seem really easy. That's the thing. And even that, the way that she blends kind of documentary realism with fiction, she's done that in her other films. That's a harder thing to pull off than I think, you know, she makes it seem like. So yeah, I just like everybody else on the planet, seemingly, I really love this. And I'm happy to see it getting, you know, actual awards consideration, because it seems like a movie that might be too, quote unquote, slight for, say, the Academy Awards. And it absolutely isn't. It's about
big things. No, I think once you have an award-winning actress involved, it's
that helps
with attention. But Nathan, I agree with you. It's also the one thing that you didn't mention is it's a PN to the West in terms of these huge landscapes, and much like the Rider portion of it is filmed in the Badlands. And I think most people, maybe not most people, but a lot of people visit the Badlands and they're just sort of passing through. Whereas we have the opportunity to spend more time there, and you do realize how, you know, stark and beautiful the landscape of the West is. And as someone who has actually been to Empire, Nevada, if you go north out of Reno, you pass through it heading toward Gerlach, and who wouldn't want to go to Gerlach, Nevada? but I think one of the reasons why this worked is, one, Frances McDormand slips seamlessly into these settings in which she finds herself. I mean, you know, she played things very realistically, and at times you didn't really think she was acting at all, that she just met up with these people and they were hanging out. And so the fact that the director uses so many non-actors, I think it almost required Frances McDormand to change up things that she did, but she did it so well. Another reason why I think that we never really feel sorry for Fern, the primary protagonist, is because, you know, people find themselves in these different situations by choice, chance, or circumstance. And we discover as time goes on, even though Fern's town went away, and even though Fern's husband died and so forth, we discovered that she had other choices. And this is a lifestyle. This is a way of connecting with the world that she opted to have. And we get that feeling about many of the other people who she encounters throughout this. And so I think that, you know, if someone were thrust into these circumstances, which are less than ideal, she's living in a van without some of the amenities that we take for granted, I think that would be more disconcerting. And, you know, we find out that, you know, she feels comfortable. I mean, she has this routine. It doesn't look like a routine, but it really is a routine. And she has a sister. So again, I think that we connect with her character, and we don't feel sorry for her at any point, even though it's not a lifestyle any of us might choose.
Yeah, I want to say that I don't disagree with anything that either of you have said. I really ended up liking Nomadland a lot. But I think that it's really important for us to stress that this is a film festival movie. This is the anti-Hollywood movie. This is not going to be anything anybody who watches a Hallmark movie ever even expects. And in fact, I suspect that a lot of people at the end of Nomadland are going to go, what was that about? Simply because it doesn't meet the expectations that Hollywood has given us. That doesn't mean that it isn't a wonderful movie, and in many ways, a scintillating exploration of a life that many of us are never going to experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think that again, it was kind of that conditioning I was talking about at the top of the show, that idea that we keep waiting for, you know, an ABC plot to kick in here, and it never does. It's almost like a series of vignettes. I think that's in keeping with sort of the documentary style filmmaking that Zhao has here. I mean, there are scenes where we see Fern and her friends go to an RV show, and they're walking around and looking at these models that they'll never be able to afford. And one of them says, like, this is practically a mansion compared to the van that I live in. And then we see all of the odd jobs that she's taken. She works at this roadside shop that sells gems and rocks and things. She gets a job in the kitchen at Wall Drug, the tourist spot in South Dakota. And so, yeah, you kind of wait for there to be an overriding narrative, and there isn't, because that's not really what this movie is going for. This movie is going for, you know, the rhythms and patterns of real life, which doesn't often follow a logical conclusion. But I think what it's about, what Nomadland is about, these big ideas of economic inequality and displacement, physical displacement, emotional displacement, economic displacement, I think
and
it's
how
saying
people survive and thrive, even despite everything.
Right.
And don't thrive. I mean, I don't want to say that this movie is all good or all bad. We see all sides of it.
But and we can see that this lifestyle has been working for her up to this point. But we also are introduced to some of her friends who are aging and are starting to have some physical problems. And we see that Fern herself is starting to have some physical problems. And so, as you mentioned, the economic displacement, the reality of aging, the healthcare system, availability of healthcare, and so forth. As you mentioned, there are these big themes, but they're integrated.
And nothing hits you over the head. There is no smack in the face here. It is a slice of life, and that's exactly what it's meant to be. And we were talking about Nomadland. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the Korean-American film Minari. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hey, this is Rick Steves, not traveling, but ready to talk about travel and our hopes for the future. Join me and Doug Nedvornik on Thursday, March 18th for a live broadcast from 6 to 7 p.m. We'll discuss the impacts of COVID-19 restrictions on the travel industry and on our lives. And I'll take your calls at 800-328-5729. Travel with Rick Steves has been airing on KSFC ever since 2005. In fact, you were the second station in the country to air the program, so I'm glad to be able to come to you in this special event from my home across the Cascades in Edmonds, Washington. Listen and call in Thursday, March 18th at 6 p.m. on the stations of Spokane Public Radio.
March 18th at 6 o'clock on both KPBX and KSFC. Event donors for this exclusive live broadcast include Strong Solutions, Hamilton Studio, MTR Communications, and Thomas Hammer Coffee Roasters.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Ann Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Chloe Zhao's film Nomadland. Let's now move to Lee Isaac Chung's feature, Minari. Based on Chung's own childhood experiences in Arkansas, Minari depicts a world in a way that, like Nomadland, could have gone in an expected direction if given the Hollywood treatment. And that direction likely would have been a study of culture clash, one that pits the residents of a rural southern town against a family of immigrant outsiders. But thankfully, Chung avoids that cliche. Instead, Minari, which takes its title from a parsley-like vegetable common in Korean cooking, explores the complexities of life itself. Korean immigrant Jacob takes his family, consisting of wife Monica and their two children, preteen Anne and baby brother David, to live in a mobile home on an isolated farm, something that doesn't thrill Monica at all. And their ongoing squabbles, complicated by David's serious medical condition, by Monica's guilt over not looking after her mother, and by the rough trade of farming itself, cast a shadow over everything. Minari has moments of humor, especially when foul-mouthed grandma does enter the picture. In the end, though, Chung's film remains an honest portrayal of the strain that personal needs have on any enduring sense of family unity.
The fact that we're discussing these two films in sort of back-to-back seems appropriate because they are both small films. And yet they're a slice of life that presents larger issues, but doesn't, you know, as you said, Dan, give them the Hollywood treatment. So this film, Minari, and we've had some discussions about how you pronounce that Korean vegetable that I kept asking Dan, is it like cilantro? Do you think it's like cilantro? So we've gone back and forth about how to pronounce it, but I do think that throughout the film, they say Minari or some equivalent thereof. So it really focuses on each of the characters in this family together, because it is an ensemble cast for sure. And also it focuses at different points on each of their lives and what's happening for them individually. And I think that this is supposedly takes place in Arkansas. It was filmed in the Tulsa area. And you get this sense of beauty and isolation and struggle because these are people you know, who have moved to this area from a more urban environment to follow Jacob's dream of being a farmer. And of course, we're expecting that, you know, things will go awry, that they will experience, ethnic discrimination and so forth. And we see just a slight hint of that. But for the most part, it's sort of the story of how people, you know, form their own community, how they reach out and make connections. The only recognizable actor in this film from the U.S. is Will Patton, who shows up at one point, and you think you absolutely have him nailed. And that's not what happens at all. He, again, forms a relationship with the people with whom he's dealing in a way that we don't expect. The grandma, yeah. I mean, that really was an Oscar winning performance, because again, she comes on the scene and you think that she's going to be the docile grandma, and as David,
or the Shanghai wife who rules over the roost.
Right. And as David notes early on, you're not really like a grandma at all, are you? And we find out that's absolutely true. But a series of events occur that, you know, we again think we know how it's going to play out. Doesn't go that way. The acting performances here, I thought, were pretty amazing. And at least in the version that we saw, we did have the opportunity to have the entire cast, including the kids, talk about their experiences making the film. The director, you know, is telling at least a semi-autobiographical story. And I thought it was charming and beautiful and fascinating.
Yeah, I want to call out the actor specifically, because there is one other hugely recognizable face in here, which is right. Steven Yeun, who plays the father. He was, of course, on The Walking Dead. He was in the Korean film Burning as well. But he and Yari Han play the parents. Alan Kim and Noel Cho play the kids. And then Yoo Jung Yoon as the grandmother, who, you're right, is such a wonderful character. The way that she comes in and is almost conspiratorial with the little boy, with David, and how he's kind of suspicious of that fact and sees her as just as much of a foreigner as all of these white Arkansas people think of him. And just the way that they bond, but then fall apart again, how they both watch professional wrestling together and she gets more into it than he does. I loved that relationship. And again, like with Nomadland, you have Minari as a film that is more about, you know, little details and small observations than it is about a traditional plot. I do think that there are some contrivances later on in this film where a character would say or do something that felt significant. And then I thought, I think I know what's going to happen. And then in the next scene, it did happen. But I think that these plot points are coming from a place of truth. Obviously, you have Chung basing this on his own childhood, but I was just thinking of those plot points aren't what I'm going to take away from Minari, though. It's all these little scenes. Like, there's a moment where the grandmother first comes to live with them and she brings these boxes of Korean food with her, and her daughter, taking out this giant bag of dried anchovies, starts crying because she hasn't smelled this food since she moved to America. There's nowhere for her to eat it. And the little observations of they have all of these old tapes of just Korean television, reruns of Korean television that they watch, as if it's a way of kind of reminding them what it's like in their native country. There's a scene where they go to the church and, you know, they're the only non-white people there. And the pastor says, if this is your first time at the congregation, stand up. And you think, well, everyone here knows that, you know, who's here for the first time. And it's just this moment of, you know, kind of othering that happens, these kind of microaggressions that are going on. So I do think that it is just, it has all of these lovely little moments in it. Again, it's a film that is kind of in a minor key as far as, you know, traditional plot and story elements go, but I think that's okay. I think the characters are so rich here, and the attention to detail is, I think anyone would recognize that it's really fine.
You know, speaking of church going, there's one point in Minari that I particularly enjoyed, and that was where they're working at this factory in which they're taking little chicks and baby chicks and separating the boy chicks from the girl chicks, because the boy chicks don't taste as good, and exactly. Mm-hmm. So they aren't worth anything, which is really different than many Asian societies, which
valorize
the boys over the girls. But at any rate, Monica turns to one of her co-workers and goes, hey, you know, we should start our Korean church. Then the woman looks at her and goes, hey, a lot of these Korean people came here to get away from church. And I thought, wow, that is really an interesting perspective.
Yeah, that factory, that's a backdrop against which we're operating the entire time, because that seems to be the option that's available. But this just shows, you know, trying to make your way as a small farmer is challenging. The family has water issues. You know, we see the dad is stubborn, but yet visionary at the same time. And so at different points throughout the film, we identify, you know, with one of the characters. And I think that it was fascinating because it sort of plays into these relationships. So David thinks his grandma is so atypical, but in the end, she's really not. She's providing something to this child. And the other thing that's happening in this film is David's health situation. And his parents, his mom in particular, is just sort of coddling him. And grandma's not down with that at all. And so we're worried, is something horrific going to happen? And, with regard to David, and it doesn't go in that direction. And I really appreciated that about the film. Nathan, you're right. It does. The denouement felt a little forced, throughout the film.
And abrupt.
Right. And then Minari, we find out sort of that is kind of a symbol for everything that's happening, you know, that there's this something that grandma planted just kind of randomly by a creek bed. And that seems to blossom and flourish just much like this family is doing for most of the film.
Yeah. You know, what strikes me about our conversation about this is really how much is going on in this movie. I mean, this is not an epic film. It's under 2 hours, but just the amount of stuff that he's able to pack in small passing moments in gesture. I mean, I can't wait to watch this again. We should say we saw it through an early kind of virtual theater situation. It's supposed to be available on VOD starting this weekend. So it's out there and it's available. And I think a lot of people are going to be pleasantly surprised by this one.
Yep. And that was Minari, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed Nomadland. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarbert for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you, too, our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, and we'll again check out all the best that streaming cinema has to offer. Until then, remember these words from filmmaker Cameron Crowe. In the future, everybody is going to be a director. Somebody's got to live a real life, so we have something to make a movie about. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.